Let's get corrupted. What is going on, everybody? It's your boy Joe with Meteoric Serpents coming back at you for another episode of the Colubrid Corruption Podcast. Guys, it's episode number 45. What's going on? I hope you're all doing super well tonight and this week and all that good stuff. You guys are in for a treat. We have someone on tonight with a very long history in the hobby, especially a long history working with the species that we're going to be talking about. So this is definitely going to be a good one. I know people were pretty excited for this. Anyone who's listening here for the first time, make sure you hit that like and subscribe button here on YouTube. I really appreciate that. It helps boost it out to more reptile lovers. All that good stuff. So make sure you leave that like. It helps out. Leave a comment if you're watching the replay afterwards. I appreciate that. And yeah, let's keep those subscribers going. You know, we passed that 1,000 mark. Let's keep it running even higher. And then you could also catch this on all the major audio platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Great place to, you know, if you listen when you're driving to work and stuff like that. Sometimes I even still use YouTube. But yeah, if you're listening on there, make sure you leave a 5-star rate and leave a nice review. That helps it out too. Share it with a friend who likes colubrids. Maybe they'll, you know, listen to this. Maybe it'll make them want to get a colubrid. That's the point of the show, Colubrid Corruption. You already know. And then, guys, as usual, I'm repping one today. We always got the Meteoric Serpents t-shirts available and the Colubrid Corruption or the Let's Get Corrupted shirts with the Rhino Rat on it. I have those. yeah, I know. People like to say when I'm wearing a black t-shirt, it does look like I'm floating. I'm sorry. If you want one of those, you could send me a message. I have all sizes available. So yeah, let me know. And then guys, as you could see, all my social medias are linked in the description or the show notes, however you're listening to this. Go follow me on there. Go follow me on Instagram. It's pretty much at Meteoric Serpents everywhere. If you go to Morph Market and Show Me Marketplace, you could find all my available animals as well. I do have some stuff available still, so go check that out. Let's see. Yeah, make sure you guys are supporting USARC, USARC Florida. Those are the organizations that fight for our rights to keep our reptiles, prevents legislators for making decisions about how we keep our pets. We obviously don't want that. So definitely make sure you're supporting those organizations. I'm a member of both. It always helps. And the cheapest memberships are so inexpensive on a monthly basis that I think if you're in the hobby, you should be contributing. So that's that. Guys, also in the first link in the description below, you can find the link to the Meteoric Serpents Patreon. That's a way for you guys to get a little more behind the scenes action of what's happening here at Meteoric Serpents. Early notification of what podcasts are coming in terms of like guests and stuff like that. Really cool community. We had a new member join last week. Shout out Ed, if you're listening, whenever you're listening. Definitely consider joining that. It supports me, also supports this podcast getting better, and I always want to bring a better experience to you guys and do more with the show. So, that's always appreciated. You could also, if you want to do like a one-time little thing, you could always, there's a super chat button. If you're on your phone, it's in like the bottom right corner of the chat. You could always throw that in there if you want to, or you want to say something important, or you just want to support me. That's always cool. And then, guys, as always, this podcast is brought to you by Show Me Reptiles Show and Show Me Marketplace. Like I've always said, and hopefully we get to talk about Colubrid Fest soon, but Show Me Reptiles is the organization that put on Colubrid Fest. And Mickey did a great job with that and getting it all together. And like I've said, I know next year is going to be even better. On top of that, Show Me Reptiles does shows throughout the country, all over the place. So if you're looking to, whether you're a vendor or just a attendee, make sure you go check out Show Me Reptiles. I have the websites linked in the description, so you could go check that out. See if there's a show near you and go check it out. And you could also go to the Show Me Marketplace. That's another way for you to buy and sell your reptiles. So definitely go check that out. And then before we get started, oh boy, as usual, it's like, you know, it's like I never pick in time. I say I'm going to pick. I'm sitting on the hashtag, and then I did not pick hashtag Kluber Corruption of the Week. And I'm trying not to pick a repeat also. You guys got to use the hashtag more, guys. If you want to be featured, hashtag Kluber Corruption on your Kluber photos. That way I could show off one of your animals once a week. And yeah, I'll give you a little shout out on the show. Let's see. Oh, shoot. All right, I saw something cool. Of course, it's Kayla. I'm using the same people every time because the same people are using the hashtag. Kayla, again, infrared reptiles, Madagascar cat-eyed snake. You know, we give the colubroids some love, too. So, yeah, go check that out. Go follow Kayla. She was a guest on the show. Go listen to her episode. That was quite a few months ago now. That was a while. It's always crazy to me. Oh, guys, I also, you know, I completely brushed by the fact that we're officially 1 year into doing this show. 1 year of Kluber Corruption, which is freaking awesome. I can't thank you guys enough, one, for supporting the show. Yeah, sorry, I totally brushed over that. But yeah, that's one full year of doing this show. When I was coming up with the show, I was pitching the idea to a bunch of people. I was like, hey, what do you think of this? You know, I see this, you know, there's this podcast space out there. CCR was going strong. Obviously, they were a big influence. But I noticed there was this element of no live show. And I really like you guys interacting in the chat. It means a lot when people are coming live to watch and listen to the show. And I didn't think I wasn't expecting much. But I have to say, over the last year, growing this, I don't even like want to call you guys an audience, but like you guys are like my friends for supporting me every week. So I just really appreciate it. 1 year down of Kluber Corruption. I know we skipped a few weeks, but I promise I'm trying my best to be as consistent as possible, getting one episode per week. And we've been doing a good job the last few months. And I have some really cool stuff planned for you guys. Not for you guys, but like really cool episodes planned. Hopefully those come to fruition, and yeah, we'll just keep this going. So thanks, Mike. Be careful what you wish for. All right, cool. So let's say what's up to the chat real quick, and then we're going to introduce our guests. We got Villarino Reptiles tuning in. What's up, Emilio? Hope you're doing well. Adam from Ivory Kluber Co., one of the Patreon members. Appreciate you. Thanks for being here. We got Krista from Neurofy Exotics. Appreciate you. We got, I believe it's Chris from Reptiles and Oddities. I'm so sorry. It's Chris. We got Studio Cold Blood. What is going on? Appreciate you. We got Keller in the building. We have Edward. I think that's Ed from the Patreon. I'm almost positive. So what's up, Ed? Appreciate you tuning in today. We got Joanne. What's up, man? Yo, by the way, I've been meaning to say this. I'm so sorry for mispronouncing your name up until now, because I only realized from your episode on the Retic Lounge that I was mispronouncing it. So my apologies. It's Joanne, guys. And then, yeah, we said Mike was in the chat tonight. All right. But guys, without further ado, and there's going to be a lot of history packed into this episode, and I hope you guys are all ready for it. We have John Lasseter of Coastal Bend Captive Breeding. I almost butchered that name before. I had to like memorize it in my head. It's a long one. But John's a cool dude. We met at Daytona very briefly, and then we got to hang out all weekend at Colubrid Fest. He breeds a lot of cool species, as you could see in you know, the thumbnail picture here. Just a bunch of really high quality animals. And you know, he bred his first snakes in 1997. So it's, you know, coming on close to 30 years of him doing this. So really excited to bring him on. But without further ado, let's welcome John to the show. What's up, man?
Hello, guys. How y'all doing?
Pretty good, man. How are you?
I'm good. If you look around, you can see some toys. I'm a toy collector, too.
Yeah.
I can only afford two hobbies at a time, and I have like four. So
Well, I'm glad you could at least afford two, because I think for most of us, it's just the one, and it's the snakes.
Well, there was a time I could only afford one. So, when I was your age.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But no, I really appreciate you coming on. I knew I wanted to bring you on, and the time came around and it lined up, and I was like, hey, let's get John on to talk some king snakes. I haven't really highlighted a bunch of these species on, you know, this show before, so I'm really excited to hear what you have to say. But as usual, I always like to let everyone do kind of a little intro. So I do want to hear how you really got into the hobby in the first place and how that kind of segued into where you are today.
Okay. My history, in the 70s, I grew up on 100 acres in Rockport, Fulton, Texas, right on the coast of Texas. With herp, I didn't even know the term herp. I would hunt for snakes, and I found everything I could find on the 100 acres. My biggest finds were like 12 Texas scarlet snakes, which, since I became a true herper and kingsnake.com came out in the 90s, I've only known of two found since then. So
okay,
they're pretty rare there now. I don't know if they're still on the property that I lived on or not. So in the 70s, I would catch Texas rat snakes. I know Joe likes Texas rat snakes, yeah. But I would catch Texas rat snakes, Great Plains rat snakes, and keep them for days or weeks at a time. Find moles, find lizards, find anything I could find to try to feed them. And then when they started turning things down, I know I wasn't keeping them right in the 70s, I would let them go. My dad was the only good snake was a dead snake type of guy, so he was scared to death of them. But he was an auto mechanic, and he owned a traveling auto mechanic business called Mobile Mechanic Service. So he did a lot of work on what we call snowbirds, which are the winter Texans that would come down to Rockport at the Goose Island State Park. And I got to know the ranger there real well. And I started asking some questions about the snakes and lizards. And he would hand me pamphlets. And I read all the pamphlets and learned all the non-venomous and venomous and the lizards we had in the area. And then, like, me and my dad would be hunting. He'd want to kill a snake, and I'd go pick it up and say, look, it's a rat snake, and he would freak out. But that's kind of my story in the beginning. And then I went through high school and didn't really keep any snakes. I was always interested with them. I went to college. I walked on the baseball team at UT Arlington back in 1990. And UT Arlington is a huge herpetoculturist, herpetology school, biology school. And I saw everything in jars that I ever wanted to see. And I learned a lot about them then. And then after that, I came back and I moved to Corpus, which is only 40 miles away from home. And I had a buddy that had a boa and a Great Plains rat snake. And I told him I have always been interested in reptiles. Alan Tennant wrote a Texas Reptiles book called Texas Guide to Reptiles. I got it, and our goal was to catch everything in Nueces County, Texas.
Okay.
And we found every single snake there was in Nueces County, Texas, except for a Caligaster, which was in far west Nueces County. And I think only one other have been found since then. But and then 1995 came around. Everyone got Windows 95, got computers in their home. And back in 1995, we didn't know websites. So we just typed in snakes.com. Nothing come up. And we just played around with it until I typed in kingsnake.com. And kingsnake.com came on. And I wasn't married yet, but I found out that it was like a reptiles were like $1 billion a year industry, and people were breeding them and selling babies. I didn't even know. And I learned what the term herping meant and all that. It was very enlightening to me. In 97, I got married and got my wife interested into my hobby. And we went to all the Texas, well, 96, we went to, I got married in 97, went to all the reptile shows in Texas and got breeding stock. We didn't buy babies back then. We were looking for adults, and I found my mentors then. My mentors are Don Shores, Don Soderberg, and Mike Price. I don't know if anyone knows those people, but they were huge breeders, huge influence on the hobby at the time. And I bought stock from them and bred my first snakes in 97. What got me
Which
hooked
were
on
what,
one,
by the way?
which were Alterna, Leonis, and California Kings. But in 1993, when I moved back to Corpus and we got the book and we were going to try to find all the snakes in Nueces County, I found a clutch of 13 eggs and I did not know what they were. But I had a book, A to Z of Snake Keeping by Chris Madison. He's a good guy. That taught me how to incubate these things, which was very elaborate. Nothing I do today, but I filled up an aquarium with water and I put a cinder block brick in there
Oh yeah.
to
And the
where it
old
was above
water
the water
heater?
with the aquarium heater in it. And I hatched. It was weird though. It's different hatching back then than it is now on with that method. When I opened the lid, all 13 were pipped at the same time, which is very interesting. And then I found out what they were. I put an ad on kingsnake.com because I got to keep half of them. My buddy that had the boa and the Great Plains rat snake at the other half. So I sold all of them to San Diego Zoo. And back then you had to get FedEx certified. You had to send in a box with triple barrier. And the triple barrier is the cardboard box, the styrofoam, and the container the snake's in. So it's the same exact thing that we do now, we did back then too. And they would certify you as a reptile shipper. And I got certified and I sent him six Great Plains rat snakes. Didn't even know how to sex them, so I didn't know what the genders were. So I sent them to him, and at 10 o'clock the next morning, FedEx called me and said, "Why are you sending snakes to this man?" They didn't know if they were venomous, I was trying to kill him or what. And I said, "He works for the zoo. I'm sending him to for his display at the zoo." "Oh, he works for the zoo? No problem." They hung up, and 10 minutes later, they called back and said, "The courier will not take these snakes on his truck." So I had to call the man to come get them, and he went and got them. So if you see any South Texas Milmorum now instead of Great Plains rat snakes, at the zoo there, they're from my stock.
Very cool. That's awesome.
And then after that, I tried to concentrate on things I liked and not what was big in the hobby. I wasn't in it to make money. I saw the potential, but I never really, I'm happy if I pay for my expenses all the time, every year, because I have a real job that pays me well. So I bred Alterna from 97 till last year. But last year was, well, the year before last. I bred Leonis every year since then. My favorite snake, I'm saying it here, my Mex-Mex, I didn't get for like 5 years later. I didn't get till like 2003. And then I started breeding them in like 06. Ruthven Eye were the only other ones available, and Greer Eye. Ruthven Eye I bred from like 06 on. Greer Eye, I had pairs, I got rid of them, had pairs. They were kind of difficult to me in the beginning to because they were a true montane snake, like a Zenata or Pyromelana. And I got rid of a lot. And then about 7 years ago, I produced my first clutch of Greer Eye. And now it's just like any other snake. I know how to breed them now. And the one snake, I mean, Mex-Mex, Ruthven Eye, Leonis, Greer Eye, Alterna. The sixth one is Web Eye, and I don't think there's any of those in the United States. They were named in 2005. The Lacey Act Amendment in 83 or 84 said that we have to follow all the other nations' laws on flora and fauna. So even though the people were smuggling back before that, they didn't get busted. They didn't get in trouble. So after 83, 84, it was all it all shut down, or they were very quiet about it. There's a rumor that maybe the Germans, because the Germans don't have the Lacey Act, maybe the Germans have some over there, a web eye. But that's my most wanted snake of all time right now, just so I could say I have all of them. Because I bred Zenata Pyro. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, WebEye, I don't even think that's a name I've actually heard before. And what exactly, I'm sorry, just clarify with common names. Like, what are we talking about on WebEye?
It's Webb's King Snake.
Okay.
It was found in Sinaloa, which is the worst part of the whole state. I mean, the whole country. And a place on Highway 40 that Dr. Bryson, he's a buddy of mine, I saw him out alterna hunting a couple years ago. Anyway, Bryson found this snake that looked like in between a Noblakai and a Mex-Mex, or a Noblakai and a Greeri. It's amazing. All these snakes live on these elevated areas, so there's no crossbreeding going on. But there are relics crossbreeding from history of when the mountains emerged, right? So all these genes got split up into these isolated populations, and WebEye kind of look like between Noblakai and Greeri.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
But it wasn't named until it was found in, like, I think 2001, 2003 or something like that. But they didn't get it ID'd and named after Dr. Webb until 2005.
Gotcha. Okay. And, you know, I just want to backtrack a little bit. What I always find so interesting, and sorry to the, you know, all the listeners who have heard me say it a bunch of times. What's funny is, like, you know, how I mentioned, like, oh, like, I knew what King Snake was even being a young person. And, like, even knowing that, you know, that old incubator set up. It's funny because I worked at that pet shop that I always talk about. And my boss was always an old school guy. He still is. He doesn't even have a cell phone. My old boss, Gary. He doesn't even have a cell phone, but he was around. He was, you know, when reptiles were coming up in, you know, the pet trade in general. He was doing it back then. So that's where I learned that stuff. He used to go on King Snake. Like, he barely used Morph Market. I would watch him surf King Snake looking for these snakes or turtles that he was looking for. And then, you know, that's where I learned that incubation method. Now, I'm pretty sure that's how I incubated my first clutch of Texas rats ever, was that method, because I didn't have an incubator. I was like, well, I have this extra fish tank. I could just, you know, DIY it. I got it. And that's where I learned it. So, you know, it's so interesting how that's, like, passed down. And, you know, I'm always curious to hear about how it was in, like, the old school reptile days, like, before it got as big as it was today. But turns out I actually know quite a bit already just from, you know, being around someone who was in it for that long.
You know what I use for incubation substrate?
I'm going to guess it's not perlite or vermiculite since you're saying that.
It was wet paper towels.
Really? Okay.
That I had to wet 3 times a week. Yeah. I mean, we've come a long way since then, right?
Yeah, man. That's yeah, because, like, spraying those down a bunch of times, like, you know, trying to keep the eggs dry themselves, but yeah.
And then my next 5 years was on top of my hot water heater that I swear got to 90 degrees, and I found out that, you know, these snakes, I don't know about a lot of other snakes. I mean, I know all about Getula, however you want to say it, and a lot about rat snakes. Which is makes up all of our colubrids in the United States almost.
Yeah.
But if you hatch them hot, if you keep the incubation temperature hot, they hatch out in 40, 50 days, and they're small, hard to get feeding. If you cool them or incubate them around 78 degrees like I do now, 60, 70 days, and they're healthy and they're a whole lot bigger. Low.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I've learned over the years, and that's how I've decided to kind of go about it, even, like, with, you know, the Texas rats, and I get really nice-sized babies, and I'm just like, okay, like, you know, 65, 67 days, like, I don't mind waiting the extra few days. There's no rush there.
Right. And you think about the wild, and, like, where I found these eggs back in 93, they were, like, in the mud underneath a piece of tin in the shade. that barely ever saw 80 degrees. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So I like using a lot from what I found from herping, because I was a field herper first and still am a field herper, and I try to try to replicate the wild as much as I can.
Yeah.
I don't have 1,000 acres to keep a pair of Alterna on, but I have Applegate enclosures and 32 quart tubs to try to replicate a thermal gradient and things like that.
Awesome. So I kind of want to get into the species you keep, and I know you wanted to talk a little bit about history, and I'm all for it. And I know there's been a bunch of taxonomy things, and you know, things get confusing sometimes depending what you're talking about. So let's hear it about some of those species. If you want to talk about I'll let you take the reins. I was going to say Alterna first, but if you want to talk about something.
I want to go chronological in the way when they were found in the wild.
Okay.
And Mex-Mex. Mex-Mex were found in, I think, 1879, and they weren't named until 1884. And all six of these species at one time were Lampropeltis mexicana. So that's why we call them Mex-Mex, because it was Lampropeltis mexicana, mexicana. Just like Lampropeltis triangulum on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Right. But we call them Mex-Mex because San Luis Potosi kingsnake is hard to say. Right? So we call them Mex-Mex. They were identified in 84. And then Ruth Van Eye, which is the Cuartero kingsnake, was found in like 1892. I think it was a few years after they named Mex-Mex, and they were ID'd. They weren't ID'd until 1920. It was a specimen found, and it was in formaldehyde. And I forgot the name of the scientist, sorry. And they found another one, and they compared it back to this one in 1920, and they finally got the ID. Ruth and I was one of the first in 82. Dr. Garska claimed it its own species, so it was then Lampropeltis Ruth and I, a binomial name instead of the trinomial name of Mexicana Ruth and I. Then one of my other favorite kings is Leonis, which has very many names: the variable king snake, Therai, the Nuevo Leon king snake, right? It was found in 1893, which was only a year after the Ruth Van Eye was found that was pickled. and then it wasn't named until, it was named that same year, I believe. So in 1924, this is the whole debacle between what everyone thinks a Therai is and what everyone thinks a Leonis is. That's one of your main questions, right? You probably saying they're all Therai. I used Therai from the day I began until 2015 or so. So there was this colonel, John Thayer, that was in Mexico, and he found a bunch of snakes on the eastern mountain range of Mexico, and they were banded, not saddled like a Leonis phase. They were milk snakes phase Therai, but he didn't know what they were. So he took them to Dr. Loveridge, and Dr. Loveridge named them Therai without even knowing that Leonis was already named and that they could produce both in the same clutch.
Okay.
It wasn't all straightened out on paper until 2017 when my buddy Robert Hansen and Jerry Salmon put out the Mexicana Bible, we call it. It was a paper in 2017 that straightened them all out, and they're all separate species because there's no overlapping range that they could both live on between each species.
Gotcha.
So the next one's Alterna, and it has a similar story. The first one was found in like 1901 in the Davis Mountains, and it was named the Ophiobolus, which was the name for Lampropeltis back then. Mexicana Alterna. Alterna has alternates in between the saddles, or there's primary saddles and alternate saddles. So Got this it. One had thin saddles and had alternate saddles. So that's why they named it Alterna. So in like the Eastern Range in 40s or early 50s, they found Blairi, and they thought it was a different species. So it had to be the 40s, because 1950 was the year that there was a animal caught 9 miles west of Dryden, Texas, and okay. It was a banded face, had thick orange bands with a gray ground color
of like Alterna.
Yeah, but they didn't know what it was, right?
Right.
They named it Blairi, but in 50 when they bred it, I don't think I know when the first Blairi was found, actually. But I know in 1950 they bred this Blairi to another Blairi, and it produced Blairi and Alterna babies. And they said, gotcha. They're polymorphic. They're not different species. Yep. So they call them all Alterna now. Same story with the Leonis before that. They were named Leonis before, and in one clutch you can get both. So I don't know how true that is if you breed an Eastern Thayeri Leonis to an Eastern Leonis, if you will truly get Leonis phase. When all the Leonis came over, we hardly had any locale data. So we're just breeding. Gotcha. We're just breeding them from what we got back in 1984 at the latest. Right. Since then, there was a few confiscations, a few handed out to people we knew and then distributed. But then after Alterna was Grierai, it wasn't found until 1958 in Rancho Santa Barbara, Mexico, which are, it's in Durango. So Grierai are Durango Mountain Kings. They weren't ID until like 3 years later. They were called the Grierai after Dr. Greer. And there's only been one other locale other than Rancho Santa Barbara come into the United States, and it was last year.
Okay.
So none of these are able to come over to the United States as wildcats or F1s right now. I've been trying since the 90s, trying to get more over here, the late 90s, early 2000s, all the way to now. F2s have been successfully imported from breeders in Mexico, from Aguas Calientes, which is another locale of Grierai now.
Okay.
And then the last one is Webeye, which was named in 2005 by Dr. Bryson, named after Dr. Webb. I think Dr. Webb got bit by a wolf snake in Asia, and there was no anti-venom close to him, and he didn't make it. But that's why we named it Webeye.
Gotcha.
So okay. There's the six, and that's the taxonomic history.
Yeah.
Like I said, 2017 was a year where now it's Lampropeltis mexicana, Lampropeltis ruthveni, Lampropeltis leonis, and no more Mexicana trinomial subspecies name.
Gotcha.
So people say, I hear a lot of people talk about Getula and line breeding, and how maybe they might get, or milk snakes, line breeding them. I don't know how many generations it may take, but they're talking about introducing new blood, right? I tested Leonis. I bred it for 6 generations in a row with no bad outcome at all. Alterna, I bred for 4 generations.
So you're talking breeding like siblings to siblings?
Yep. Same blood to same blood. And I think, I go every year to West Texas and hunt Alterna. And I think all the snakes inbreed in the wild too.
You know, yeah, what I mean? I'm sure.
They're isolated population. They got to be related, right? If everything lives on this one peak.
Right. Makes sense.
They won't go down to the grasslands and travel, but some have. I know. I'm sure there is some introduction of new blood every so often, but
gotcha. No, and that I'm glad you said that, because that was actually one of my questions. Because of like the limited amount of species, especially, you know, with the exception of Alterna, I guess, because you could get them in West Texas. All the Mexican species, if we can't bring in new blood for the most part, is like, how are the bloodlines being held up at this point?
Check out Greeri. Greeri are only from Rancho Santa Barbara.
Right.
And we've been breeding them since the 80s. Right? Okay. And you look at Mex-Mex. Mex-Mex are from Valle de los Fantasmas, which means Valley of the Ghost, and nearby Alvarez, which is within a few miles of VLDF. And we've been breeding them since the 80s.
Okay. Valley of the Ghost, that's a cool name. That's a cool locale to slap on it.
Valley of the Ghost, yeah. Which is 99% of our hobby has Valley of those Fantasmas.
Okay.
But we quit using the name because, like, a lot of people agree that the third generation out of the wild, maybe even the second generation from the wild, you're using selective propagation and it doesn't look like the wild animals anymore. But Mex-Mex aren't really that variable, and they look like a lot of the wild-caught pictures that I see on Robert Hansen's website.
Right. And now here's where I bring up your Instagram, and we're going to just take a look at some of the snakes. And I know, you know, we're going to scroll through an array of species here, but let's kind of just take a look. So this one is a Mex-Mex.
Mm-hmm. So ultra granite, a lot of people. So I was in the chase to produce some ultra granites. The history of the ultra granite, there's a missing link. There's a rumor that I've shared here recently on Facebook that a man by the name of Helmut Hansen from Germany was an old Alterna hunter. He got some snakes from the Galvans, which live near Alpine, Texas. Galvans got them from Doug Moody, got them from Jerry Salmon, and they had split bands, which I think we could recreate this if we bred them for five generations ourselves. Keep breeding the split bands, they'll start getting speckles. You keep breeding the speckles, you'll start getting that ultra granite look. But anyway, what's his name? Cameron Templeton, or I don't know how to say his last name, was a big importer. And in the late 80s, early 90s, the first granite phase came into the United States. Mark Bell was one of the first to get them from him. Right. And then everyone got them after that, like Mark Bell, Brian Barzik, me, Robert Hansen. And then... Gotcha. So when I had them, I kept them separate. I would not breed them to a black phase or to a classic phase back then. In the, like, 2003, I think I got my first one. I think, like, 2008, I hatched my first ones. Because, you know, my husbandry wasn't tuned in like it is now to grow them up in 3 years and be able to do all that.
Right.
Now, I think... they're not rare at all. I think the classic phase is the rarest of all Mex-Mex.
Interesting. Because
everyone has crossbred ultra granites into everything they have. I used to be able to tell, oh, that's a Bell line ultra granite. That's a Shores line ultra granite. I used to be able to look at them and tell. Now I can't because they've been crossed so many times now.
Yeah. And I feel like even, you know, as I've heard them over the years, like all I hear are the granites, and, you know, I don't typically see a ton of...
Look at that dark phase one. That's normal. Way more beautiful to me.
And this, I agree with you. This is really interesting looking. And I'm a contrast guy, so I love this. I love this coloration, the way the pattern is, and, you know, kind of banding it, you know. Yeah, that's...
This came cool. from an old collector in Mexico named Lloyd Lemke. I got to talk to him towards the end of his life in the late 90s. Lloyd Lemke, this has popped up in his collection. It's not recessive. It's like a Alterna have dark phase and light phase. Right. This is what I call black phase because that gray is black.
Yeah.
And these go through ontogenesis. They hatch normal looking, but their saddles are maroon when they hatch.
Okay.
As their body ground color darkens, their saddles turn to a red orange. very different than a like a female Mex-Mex. A lot of female Mex-Mex will just get dark in their old age. But they usually have this white border, and this has no white border around the saddles.
And I'm trying to find a normal one.
Well, that's kind of normal.
Yeah.
I believe this one is hypoerythristic, though. So
okay.
That's for me. I started crossing everything like everyone else, but I bred hypoeed to a black phase, and that's a snake turning dark, and the saddles are turning pink.
Okay. Yeah. See that. It's interesting. Yeah, man. I mean, one of the big things about, you know, all these species that you keep is just general variability. And I think that's something that I can relate to, because that's what, you know, I always say that's what I love about Texas rat snakes, because like it's like you never know what you're gonna get. And as you could see, I hope everyone's watching, you know, just scrolling through these pictures, and I know, you know, there's some different species mixed in, but like there's no two snakes here that look exactly alike. And I always just think that's so fun to have that kind of thing in the hobby, you know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
When variable king snakes hatch, I've missed the most work. I will call in sick to work. There's a green one, there's a yellow one, there's an orange one, there's a white one. There's so there that right there is from Tim Gebhart, one of the kings of variable king snakes. Back when we can sell them for $100 each, he was selling them for $300 or $400 each.
Okay.
And Tim just retired and got out, and I got his last two females, and that's one.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, and that's a beautiful animal, man. Yeah, and I mean, I don't even know what to highlight here, because you know, so just to show the audience, because if you guys don't know what we're talking about, so. The last animal and this animal, I mean, they're the same species, which right. is just super, super cool when you look at that and you're like, whoa. And it's not genetic mutations like we're looking at with some other things. That's just general polymorphism. Yeah, that you get throughout clutches, which I think is just so, it's so fun. It makes breeding them so fun. So yeah, so
click on the black one that's a little bit below that one.
Okay.
Yep. Left. No, left.
Oh, my bad. Oh yeah. The melanistic one. Yeah.
That's so there are maybe five people I know that think that this melanistic mutation is polymorphic, but me, Hansen, many others have proved it to be the only recessive trait in Leonis.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's very cool. Now, you know, here's a badass Alterna.
That's from my buddy Chris Payne Shop.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
we're gonna talk about Chris. I know he's yeah. Chris has some real nice animals. When he sends pictures, I'm just like, holy shit. But yeah, just super, super cool. But yeah, I mean, you know, instead of me drooling over all the pictures here, I do want to know, you know, with these species, because obviously it's not your, not your general North American species, them being, you know, montane and a little more like arid keeping. I'm sure husbandry is different than most of the stuff you generally keep in the US and North America in general. So I do want to hear, what is your husbandry like? Like what do you do in your room? How do you keep your stuff? And yeah, if you want to go into that.
So you would think it's different, but I keep every snake I've ever kept exactly the same.
Okay.
And the way you can do that is provide all the options for the snake, right? So I'll touch on applegate enclosures right now. And you can duplicate what I do with applegate enclosures somewhat in a large tub or large enclosure. But applegate enclosures are a huge box, like a 4x2x2, right? but they have these two tunnels. Hurry, I'm backwards. Two tunnels that go down the subfloor drawers.
Yeah.
Right. So Bob Applegate was one of my mentors and didn't know it. I used to talk to him at Daytona, but so was Frank Reedus. I just kind of took what everyone said and picked what I wanted to change, what I wanted to tweak and all that. But I got a buddy of mine, Scalebox, to build PVC Applegate enclosures. I still have some wooden ones and some melamine ones and all that, but these PVC ones are the best. So in one tub, I have in one drawer, I have a tub of damp sphagnum moss.
Okay.
Right? And the other tub is dry with just aspen. So, and I have light above, no UVB. My snakes do not even come out when the sun is out. So there's no UVB needed for montane snakes at all. Maybe Zenata would benefit from it, maybe Pyros, but I've kept them without it for 20 years and they lived, right?
Gotcha.
Okay. So above ground, there's heat tape running across the back, right? So above ground, they have light. They have cool up by the glass because I keep my room at 72 degrees.
Okay.
I keep a hot spot of 82 degrees. In a perfect world, you'd have 0 degrees and 120 degrees, but that's not possible as a keeper, right? So they would go to the back to thermal regulate a meal, to metabolize a meal. They would come to the front to conserve. 90% of the time, because light's on, they're underground. So a lot of the times I'll turn off the lights, especially during brumation, I turn off the lights. But anyway, there's windows in my snake room that give them a light cycle. So they'll be below ground and they'll be in the damp, dry, dark, if they're close below ground. In the back, they'll be damp, hot, dark. So there's three things we control. It's humidity, dampness, temperature, and light or not.
Right.
These will tell you what they want. And then on the other side, it's dry, dark, and cool, and dry, dark, and warm. Right. So if you can control those three things, even in a tub, you can, with deep substrate, a hot spot, and a hide box with moist sphagnum moss in it, you can still duplicate all those options. And I used to have a rack that had 56 tubs in it. And I used to walk up and look at all 56 tubs. And when I saw over half of them on the cool side, I would feed them. Right?
Right.
I do not think, even in Gatula, even in rat snakes, that you can make a growing snake obese. An adult snake, you can make obese. Yep. It's very difficult to make a growing snake that uses the metabolic or caloric intake to grow and to sustain. Once they get to the point where they're not growing that much and they're just sustaining, you can OD them on calories, right?
Yeah. No, so, I agree. From what I've seen, I do agree with you. Yeah.
So I've even tested Ruthven Eye and Mexmex and Greer Eye and Alterna, feeding them once every 3 days. None of them got fat or obese, right? When I would look at the baby rack and they're all on the cool side, I would feed them all. And sometimes it was every 3 days. Sometimes it was every 7 days. Sometimes it was every 5 days. Right. I've gotten to the habit now as a keeper feeding on Sunday only, right?
Okay.
Which every snake will live and they'll thrive eating once a week.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was going through testing things, right? I mean, how young can I breed these snakes at and stuff like that. I was breeding them at 18 months, getting two long eggs instead of a bunch of eggs, right?
You're talking females?
Yep.
Okay. Wow.
Sometimes they wouldn't breed at all until the third year, 2.5-year-olds. But anyway, I never weighed a snake in my life. Even when I gave them a panicure, I never weighed a snake. If I was going to flagell, I would probably weigh an adult snake and then adjust it down for smaller snakes. But I used to do that at least once a year. I used to do, I think Clint does it now too. He talked to me about it years ago. Just housekeeping, making sure there's no internal parasites at all. And I would give them all flagellum and panicure and clean them all out. And then next meal, I'll give them Nutri-Back to give them the good stuff they need back in their guts.
Yeah.
So I haven't done that in years either, and things are still good. So, like I said, 72 degree room, 82 degree hot spot, provide it warm. The reason I said 3 to 4 inches of aspen is because you won't need like 10 hides in there. They'll go in there and they'll make a hide wherever they want to be.
Yep.
Lights are off nearly all the time, but there is natural sunlight coming through the windows.
Okay.
All my snakes are underground snakes anyway. We find them at night when the sun's down. So,
right.
So darkness is a key. About 90% of the Splendida, Holberg Eye, stuff like that I found, California Kings, they've been under something during the day or out at night. So,
gotcha.
I try to use what I've done in the field to try to replicate that, right? I said that earlier. And then, like I said, I feed once a week. There should be a separate care sheet for keepers than breeders, right? Because I don't feed, like 3 weeks ago, I quit feeding them because I want them to clear their gullet before I put them down for brumation. I live in a probably hotter area than you do. It'll be 80 degrees all summer with a couple of fronts to get it down to 50 a few times. But I use a CoolBot controller on my 24,000 BTU window air conditioning unit that allows it to overcool without freezing. Back 15 years ago, I did it my old redneck way and pulled out the pitot tube, the temperature sensor, and put a heat pad on the wall and adjusted the distance from the heat pad to the temperature sensor to make it overcool because I needed 50 degrees.
Got it.
I built boxes around my air conditioning unit and put them in there. I had a restaurant, 3-door stainless steel refrigerator I set up to brumate in. This CoolBot controller is probably the best investment I ever did.
Okay.
Because I can hold my 2-car garage down to 50 degrees for 4 months. No problem.
Gotcha. And that's where you're keeping the snakes in your garage?
Yeah, I turn my garage into my snake room.
Very cool. Yeah. Awesome, man.
And then, speaking about care sheets and feeding, if you want a female snake to breed or a Mexican king snake to breed, when it comes out of brumation, you feed the females every 3 days, every 2 days. You got to feed them a lot. So per Dr. Wyman's, what was his name that was at Colubrid Fest?
Yeah.
Dr. Wyman. Yeah. You got to feed them calories to make the follicles.
Yeah.
So you feed the females a lot and the males typically will not eat. Sometimes they will, but typically they will not. The pheromones are in the air. They're thinking about breeding and not eating. And so Leonis and Alterna and Greer Eye, you got to wait for the first shed. Ruth Vinay and Mexmex, I paired them before the first shed because I can feel them ovulate.
Gotcha.
And, sometimes their first shed is a pre-egg laying shed, which is very strange. I used to wait for their pre-ovulation shed every time. And I think I missed the windows a few times by doing that. Now on April 1st, I just pair them up. And
yeah. Well, I was going to say, so that's an interesting thought. Cause like, when did you realize that like you needed to pair those snakes right away? Whereas the others, you know, you waited till after that first shed.
If you learn how to palpate a snake, you know when they're ovulating.
Okay.
When you feel the little string of pearls, the little bumps, you'll know when a pair of
Gotcha. Okay.
I used to not be able to do that. A lot of people don't know how to do that. I'll go over to Chris's house and tell him if he's ovulated or not sometimes.
Okay. Gotcha. And now when it comes to feeding too, are you strictly rodents? Do you do diverse stuff? Like what's your methodology on feeding?
If you're breeding these, in your freezer, you should have, 7 species of lizards frozen.
Oh yeah. I wasn't even talking about that yet. I'm talking strictly like okay.
So I had a snake live to age 33 and I sent it back still alive to my buddy Shannon Brown when he was still alive. So they will live fine, thrive on just rodents.
Okay. Yeah. No, I was just curious. I always
Oh,
find it
I thought you were talking about babies.
well, that's the next question. That's the follow-up, because I know these kings, and it was a subject that you chimed in on quite a bit during Colubrid Fest. These Montane kings are definitely not your most how do I phrase this right? Like ready eaters out of the egg. They want to die, as that topic
They
was
want to eat air.
rightly named. Yeah. So
The air
let's talk
people.
about that a little bit, and your methodologies and how to go about feeding picky snakes, because I know a lot of these guys can be quite troublesome. It could be daunting, especially for a first time breeder of the species.
It could be line bred for too. Feeding is a characteristic that could pass on. So
I
if
agree
you
with
got
that as
two good
well.
feeders, yeah, you could make a lot of good feeders.
Yeah.
People ask me, is a Leonis as bad as a Zanata or Pyro to get eating? I'm like, man, the worst clutch I ever had was a clutch of corn snakes. So I can't really tell you that a species is bad,
Yeah.
right? But these are lizard eaters or opportunistic king snakes in the wild. Holbrookeye are tough too because they'll eat snakes and lizards until they're like age one or so, usually in the wild. I always start out with frozen thawed. If they don't eat frozen thawed, I'll try to brain it.
Okay.
If they don't eat brained, I go to live. They don't eat live, I try to brain a live pinky, which sounds kind of gory, but
Now, before you continue, how long are you spacing in between these attempts if they're not taking?
well, I used to do every single day until they would. And I found
Okay.
out that would stress them out. So
Yeah.
I would try like every 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
Oh yeah. If they wouldn't take the live brained pinky, which sounds gruesome because it kind of is, I usually skip that step nowadays. I'll go to boiled. And
Okay.
boiled will kind of knock out 50% of your non-feeders. Rubbing it in the dirt sometimes will knock out 50% of your non-feeders. Rinsing
Okay.
it with Windex or Dawn
Dawn.
soap and rinsing it or washing it and then rinsing it will knock out 50% of your non-feeders. But when you have like 300 to 500 babies and you have like 200 non-feeders, you still got 100 that aren't eating, right?
Right.
So then scenting. Everyone says scenting, but there are probably 20 different ways to scent a pinky, right? Rubbing it on the anus of the lizard. First, you got to get the right lizard because if you just get it in a knoll and try it, and then you say, I tried lizards, I said, no, did you try a whiptail? Did you try a Scilophorus from where they're from? A little seven-banded race runner from where they're from, things like that.
Right.
So that's why I said you got to have 7 or 8 species of lizards. Mediterranean geckos work great for like 25% of the
Oh, yeah.
non-feeders. When you're down to like 100 out of 500, Mediterranean geckos work pretty good. Brown skinks work great. There are some that want to die. So when I first started getting down to, I have these 10 snakes that don't want to eat. I used to force down tails down their mouth, but
Okay.
you got to do that every 2 days because their digestion
Yeah.
will knock out a tail quick. Then you'll get a rat tail piece and shove it down their mouth. That stresses out a snake so much, and once you kick off their metabolism, you have to keep doing it.
Yep.
So I adjusted everything in my whole breeding to have babies later in the year just for this reason. Because I'm down to like 10 snakes that won't eat, I'll brumate
Okay.
them. I used to brumate them just for like 6 weeks, but I found out they will lose maybe an ounce in the whole 3.5 months.
Okay.
So I brumate them and I put some nasty, thin, these aren't going to make it babies in brumation, and they came out alive,
Wow.
right? Typically, they'll eat a boiled pinky out of brumation. And so this is what they do in the wild. They're hatched. They're underground. Underground is 55 degrees in a cave. You ever been in a cave, right?
Yeah. Not quite, to be honest.
You never been in a cave?
Not really, no.
You need to come to Texas and go in our caves. Anyway.
I've never been to Texas.
It's like 55 degrees underground, and they have that option all the time. When it's 120 outside, it's still 55 degrees in a cave.
Okay.
So they'll be able to thermoregulate. They get closer to the surface on the mountain, right? Maybe 20 feet in, 10 feet in, and they're getting some heat. And then they'll go back and reserve. Then they'll go back and eat. And then all the mice, all the lizards are doing the same thing. So a lot of that's why an Alterna has eyes, huge-ass eyes, because they hardly see the sunlight.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So all these snakes are from the same type of habitat. Some might be greener. Some might have more cacti. But they're still under rocks, underground, 90% of their life. I think when I go find an Alterna, it was just running down this crack and, oops, I came out, right? Because we cut the mountains when we made the roads. But anyway.
Yeah. No, but that's a really good tip, because I know – you know, like I was saying before, that feeding those, you know, those animals that don't want to eat, it could be really daunting, especially for someone who's like, oh, let's pick up some Alterna. You know, they raise them up, they breed them, and then they, you know, get a bunch of babies that, yeah, don't want to eat. So it's a super important tip. And again, shameless plug for Colubrid Fest, like, That was one of the topics this year, and it was a great topic. And for everyone who's listening to this episode, screen record that clip of what John just said, because, you know, it could be important for you one day, for sure.
Oh, yeah. I had many buddies that bought snakes for me, and the next 4 or 5 years later couldn't get babies to eat. So,
yeah.
But I'm always there to help.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Yes, Mike, they are.
Yeah. It's cool stuff.
But these over here, right here are Dungeons and Dragons.
Nice.
You can't see the rest of the room. Just those.
Gotcha. Let's see. We got past feeding. And then, okay, yeah. So you do the brumation. We talked about that a bit. Let's see. What did Mike say? Pairing Florida Keys corns next year. Can't wait for those breeding trials. Nice.
I never bred those before, so. I bred all the Getula and all the Mexicana and Montane stuff, but never those. Oh, no, I lied. I never got Zenata to breed successfully.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, and since I brought it up, and because we talked about it before the show started, you asked me a question. You asked what I thought about Colubrid Fest, and I kind of want to get your take, because you attended just as a straight attendee. You drove I think farther than I did to make the trip, and I kind of want to hear your feedback, your experience, what you got out of the weekend.
All right, we left on Wednesday. We hit Texarkana and slept for the night. And then when we got up, we drove through a hurricane. That was the bad part of the trip. It wasn't even that bad, except for all the 18-wheelers blowing over and wrecking. But I got there, which I thought was too late on Friday. And then I found out y'all stayed till 11 p.m. So I could have showed up at like 9, but I didn't, because I thought y'all were gone.
Yeah, we were there late that night.
I would have drank with y'all. I got there for Saturday. I already looked over the whole list of speakers, and the only one I didn't recognize was Sarah, the corn snake girl, but yeah. I knew all the other ones. It was the fastest 8 or 9 hours ever, because it was very interesting. I think the way they did it it was kind of like a live podcast is what it was. It was very interesting. Like I said, it flew by. Listen to Kayla talk. Kayla, I don't think I'm a mentor of hers, but she is one of the new up and coming top breeders.
And oh,
she
yeah.
She has an eclectic taste, and I like that. Listen to Matt Mose. I've known Matt Mose for probably 30 years, 20 years, and first time I got to see him in person. I've known Clint for 15 years or so, first time I got to see him in person. Zach Loffman, Dr. Zach. I've talked to him online many times. I just met him like 5 years ago. Finally got to talk to him in person.
Yeah.
So Saturday was a great learning experience. It was an event. It wasn't just a, like I've been to all the synopsises all over the United States and all the talks that they had at Daytona and all the talks that they had at Pomona and places like that. And this one was the most interesting to me because they were all about the types of snakes I've kept or am right. keeping. Sunday, there were maybe 100 vendors, would you say? Maybe
100? No, in terms of vendors, maybe 50. Tables, but not vendors. Yeah, there was maybe 40 to 50.
Okay. I stopped at every single table. There was nothing I would walk by. At yeah. Daytona, at Pomona, at NARBC in Arlington, I would usually walk by half of them. I mean, it's just things I'm not interested in. I ain't saying they're bad. I'm just saying they're tables that I wouldn't stop and look at everyone's ball pythons or everyone's right. crested geckos or stuff like that. But there were corns at some tables. There were kings at mostly all the tables. There were rat snakes at some tables. I picked up snakes from my buddy Brett Siebert. I picked up some from Clint.
Yeah.
Picked up some from, can't think of his name. I'm sorry. I picked up a zebra. I got a picture. You just showed it a while ago. A zebra pyro.
Okay.
Came from a line from an old man I know from California. Yeah. And it was great. I mean, shows I'm usually not there more than an hour. Like if there's a show here in Corpus, I'll go to the show maybe an hour and leave. Daytona, I like going through Daytona. I probably been to over 100 shows, and that was probably one of my top three shows of all time.
Yeah, yeah,
because it was an all weekend event that made it good instead of just a reptile expo.
Oh yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, I gotta agree with you there. You know, I talked about it. I drove as well. I vended. I was there for a talk. You know, one of the panel talks. And you know, I didn't even go to make money as a vendor. Like I was going one way or another. But the whole experience, besides my drive on the way there, which was a shit show. Besides that, it was a fantastic weekend, and I definitely do not regret making that trip. Even though I drove a lot solo, but I literally had no regrets. I genuinely had such a good time.
Yeah. Zirkel, I got to meet him for the first time too.
Yeah.
And he told me at the end, he goes, "Man, I have hardly anything to take to the next show." So I think they did great at the selling aspect.
They were slinging snakes. I know that.
I'm going to vend there next year.
I was going to say, I was going to ask that. I was like, would you consider going up to vend?
My history in vending, I probably vended 5 shows in my life and sold 3 snakes.
Okay.
Shows.
Yeah.
Because most of the shows I go to, they don't know what I have. Kluberfest, they do. They will know what I have. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That's awesome, man. I'm glad to hear that. So looking forward to that.
And I talked to Zach, and I'm probably going to be a guest speaker there also.
Yeah, I think I actually am as well with my own talk this time.
All right.
Yeah. So that should be fun.
So you didn't cool. take no hard feelings when I talked about your generation, right?
No, not at all. I talk shit about my own generation.
All right. There's nothing wrong with your generation. I have kids in their 20s. It's people that already grew up with the internet and grew up with all the answers and
yeah.
they're telling me that we're doing something wrong. Something maybe y'all don't expand. or not people, not you, but your generation does not understand, because those care sheets that are written, we didn't have those.
Yeah.
Right. Where some of us, maybe before me, were the reason that those were written.
Yeah.
Right. Remember earlier I said there should be two kinds of care sheets, those for just keepers and those for breeders, because it's kind of different. If you want to breed. So our gauging was to say you're a successful keeper was you successfully got them to breed 2 years in a row. You were able to get them to breed, recover, and breed again. That means you're doing something right. And now everyone thinks, oh, it's easy to breed. Who cares? You just put them together and they breed. But that ain't how we thought in the 80s and 90s.
Of course.
Early 2000s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've been attacked. Not attacked. I've been told a few times, well, you're doing it wrong. You're one of the old guys. I'm like, I ain't doing anything wrong. Come measure. How do you measure your snakes for how healthy they are? Come measure them. None of them are obese. None of them are thin. I don't understand.
Yeah, it is interesting, and that's why I'm glad we could have this conversation, because I agree with you for one. I think it's silly to tell someone who's been around for so long that they're doing something wrong if they really aren't. Now, if their care or their husbandry isn't on par and they're keeping their animals in shit conditions, like, because you can still breed in kind of crappy conditions. You know, we've seen what's come out over the years with especially a lot of like a couple of the retic stuff that has come out and those deplorable conditions that they've been kept in at some of these facilities. But like, there's a difference between that and what you're doing, and you have a bunch of high quality animals to show for it. And it's very clear that your husbandry is very on point in what you do. And we could even have this conversation. Like, those people would struggle to have a conversation and explain their husbandry procedures, you know? So it just goes to show, you know, especially learning from over time. And that's the thing, is like, you guys had to literally learn from scratch, and what you learned is how you do it. And I think experience is oftentimes the best teacher than someone telling you what to do and you like trying to follow it to a T and stressing out because you're not doing exactly what they did. Even I've never been like that. Like, I learned to breed the Texas rats. Like, you know, I took things from here and there, but I was able to do it sometimes. And, you know, as a young person, I'm proud that I've been able to produce them. Ball pythons, it's a lot easier than that. You kind of just slap them together and it's whatever. But no, I mean, again, it just goes to show that there's multiple ways to do something. And it's definitely wrong for people that are closer to my age or that are brand new in the hobby, at the very least, to say that old school techniques are just wrong. So I agree with you.
All right. The next step, I wanted to get into how I incubate, because it's a little different than a lot of people.
Sure.
So remember we were talking about the aquarium with the brick and the hot water heater and all that other stuff I was talking about. Now I just get a 4 or 5 inch thick tub. I got a bunch of them, and I use large granular perlite. Not the small. I mean, these are pieces of perlite, because I want the air to get underneath them, not for oxygen. I'll tell you a little bit. I never pull a clutch apart. I never all lay them in there. I never mark the top of the eggs. I've dropped eggs before and put them in there and they all hatch.
Yeah.
So I don't care if people do. I never badmouth anyone for anything like that. I set this whole clutch on top of the perlite. The perlite is not any measurement whatsoever, because I use a closed system. I'll turn on my faucet and run the tub of perlite underneath it that quick, and it's barely damp.
Okay. Right?
These snakes lay eggs in some of the driest. Even I hatch my Splendida eggs. I hatch them all the same because I use a closed system, and I'll get to that in a minute. Slightly damp perlite, large granular, set the clutch on top, put the lid on, no holes whatsoever. And I put them on my top shelf. I got a place for all of them in the snake room. where it's sometimes 80 degrees. So it's 70, 80.
So is it like a lock tub, or when you say no holes, is it literally airtight?
They're a Rubbermaid small tub with a snap lid.
Gotcha.
They're not the Rubbermaid that have the, anyway, they're sealed all the way around.
Gotcha.
They're like a food tub that you clip together, right? Because they don't need oxygen at the beginning. I'll get scared sometimes and open them up once a week or every 3 days, fan it and put it back on. But at day 45, at 78 degrees, I'll burn or pull the tape off the existing holes right now. I burn 4 holes, one in each corner on the side, on the top of the side. I put 4 holes in there. After 45 days, a week in the 4 holes, they start dimpling. And a week later, they all hatch. So this is something I've done now for 6 years. So I used to produce, let's say, out of 100 babies, I would have 10 of them full term dead in the egg.
Gotcha.
And I think they drowned. I think they're too wet. Right? So I started going with this dryer method, enclosed method. And I may get 1 out of every 100 full term dead in the egg.
Okay. Interesting.
So that's my method. I have people using it nowadays. It may have to do something to do with where I live.
Okay.
Because a lot of things I'm saying are because of where I live.
Yeah.
I live in a hot, humid environment. My buddy, Austin Bohannon, I don't know if you know him. He lives in Alpine, Texas.
I don't.
It's dry. It gets cold there. It gets hot there, but it's dry all the time. That method is tough for him to do. I think what he needs to do is get his perlite a little bit wetter than I do, so it stays longer. Because I think at 45 days it dries out so fast. I think he just needs to get it wetter. So it's some tweaks you have to do to it to make it work.
Now, here's my question. Do you think that method is solely for the species you keep, or do you think it could be a universal thing that other keepers can use across other things?
Glenn, you know Glenn Brooks, right?
Yeah.
Glenn told me it did not work for a clutch of Pituophis that he tried to incubate that way.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know. I've done every Cow King, every Desert King, every Holbrook High like that. No problem.
Like that. Yep. Okay.
I don't know. I'm on a new project with Matt Most. I don't know if you know that.
I don't think I do.
I got some Asian king snakes, Asian snakes from Matt Most that I'm helping him with. And I don't know if I'm going to try that method with them or not.
Interesting.
These are Rufo zonatum, which is red bandit snake, red bandit wolf snake. Diodon means false tooth or non-tooth or something like that. I don't want to get bit by these things. They're kind of scary. But they look like a black snake with red bands, and there's like 30 different mutations.
And interesting.
So I'm helping them out with that because
Matt's always pulling something new out of his ass.
I'm helping out with that because I have these the ability to provide all the options in Apple.
Right. Code.
So
yeah,
he likes that.
Cool. No, that's super cool. And I'm sorry, we totally brushed by this before. I know you wanted to talk about some lineages, because that's like the thing with a lot of these kings is lineages and not mutations. And that's
not locales.
What's or yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, not locales. So, yeah, and I know there's like a longstanding history, and that's how they get labeled. They get labeled by, you know, their lineage. So I'm curious to hear kind of what you have to say about that.
Okay. So back in the 90s, people did not know the difference between a Mex-Mex and an Alterna and a Grierei. They were just saddled snakes, and they just bred them together. There were milk snakes like Smith-Eye and Dixon-Eye. Japan area, Ruth and I, and they just all got crossed. And we know the names of those people that did that, and we don't blame them. We just know that we want to stay away from those lines, right?
Okay.
So we have lines of people like Mex-Mex. We need to get from Lemke, John Ruiz, Bob Applegate, things like that, because they got them and they kept them pure. Right. It's hard to say pure. They kept them species-specific. Ruth Van Eye, it's hard to tell. I mean, there's a Ruth Van Eye is another one. It's hard to find a Ruth Van Eye that's not, don't have the albino gene in it, which is, remind me to get back on track. I'm going to go off track a little bit.
Sure.
Ruth Van Eye is the first albino tricolor there ever was. In 1987, Terry Hearing, a friend of mine, he grew up some Garska animals from Dr. Garska. From Amialco, Mexico, bred them together and produced the first albino babies, a couple of them, I think. I got my first one in like 03, and it was like $800. And now they're $100 snakes. But anyway, So Ruth and I, like I said, they all come from Amialco. There might be a rare Tapalpa or Jalpan floating around, and they might have been crossed between those three locales, but they're still the same species. Leonis, since they're so variable, they've been bred to milk snakes, they've been to pyros, they've been bred to all these tricolor bandit snakes, they've been bred to Alterna and Mex-Mex. They're so polymorphic, people didn't know what they had. So we have lines that we get them from, and I recommend no one, if they want pure snakes, to go instantaneously buy the first Leonis they see available, or the first Greer Eye or Gray Band. Right. Gray Band's kind of unique because we can still find them, and they're still legally to go collect, and we have locales. The only one I've questioned in the last 5 years is the albino that popped out in Europe, because Europe is known for crossbreeding stuff, not on purpose, but maybe accidentally. And
right,
that came from a Chris Bobble line leucistic bred to Dan Johnson's line of Black Gap Ghost, which are Anary and Hypo.
Okay.
Those were bred together. I don't know if anything else was involved, but an albino popped out. So like I said, I mean, there's no Web Eye. We have Greer Eye, Leonis, Ruth Van Eye, and Mex-Mex that we have lines to get them from. And there's...
I think that comment's for you.
That's my buddy Nate. It's no shave in November. It's the only reason I have a beard going, Nathan.
Oh. There you go.
I shave from here down, though.
That's pretty much what my beard looks like.
Leonis, I think the best breeders, there's no Lasser line, hardly anything. At least that's what I think, but people tell me I'm lying because they've heard that. But I'll still sell Bobble Baits by Alaska Hansen. When Maria Heinkamp had a mix of everything, just like we do, right? Bobble and Baits had a mix of all these things, just like, anyway. But they're known lineages that have stood the test of time of not throwing albinos or something weird. So
okay,
if I ever hatched an albino, I would first say, I ain't telling anyone. I'm going to go trace the lineage back again because...
Yeah.
There was an albino Ruth Van Eye hatched in 93.
Okay.
It got killed by its mate when they tried to breed it.
Oh, man.
It's a very weird story because it was It was two lines, a daughter from this clutch bred to a son from this clutch, bred them together, and they produced an albino, which is very, very interesting how they could both be het albino.
Yeah, I mean, unless it was just, you know, spontaneous mutation, because that's how things happen sometimes, you know?
You know what a spontaneous mutation in the wild is? It's a test on evolution.
Yeah.
So... If it proves to be more better for the animals, camouflage-wise or whatever, it'll spread throughout the whole population. If it doesn't, it's detrimental. It'll absorb back into the population and pop up again later.
Interesting. Yeah.
Like, look at the Trans-Pecos rat snakes, and look at back when the wrestler dude, Dusty Rhodes, he was a wrestler's name when I first met him. Anyway, Dusty Rhodes wrote the book, and he said one out of every 10 you find in Lajitas or Studi Butte will be a blonde. First, I called him out on that and said, hell, I found 30 there. None of them have been blonde. but now you find them all the way over to South America. Now you find them all the way up to past Ojinaga or whatever that Mexican city is up on River Road. They have spread huge because they're not detrimental.
Interesting. Yeah, that's cool. I've heard that about colubrids aside. I've heard that I think it was Ryan Young has said that about chondros, and like you know how you get like red and yellow neonates? He thinks that the yellows are becoming the more like adapt to survive because they turn green quicker. Oh. So they could blend into the trees. Because cool. Red neonates usually take a bit longer to go green. So ever since he said that, I've found it fascinating. But yeah.
Sneak.
Yeah. Keeping those lines pure. So you don't like putting your own name on any of these things, even though you've been doing it for a while?
Well, I have allowed Hansen. I mean, I call thing Hansen line, but he has Bloaty line, which is a pure line. He has all the, I don't know. I don't think anything is a Lasser line.
Okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. Like Jonel Lopez, he bred everything I'm breeding. He produced a Jaguar line and he got out. And everyone calls Jonel Lopez line. So I guess I got to get out before people call it my line.
Gotcha. All right. And you know, another thing I wanted to talk about is because you've had this long tenure in the hobby is you being a bit of a mentor to some people. Like I know when I had Chris Painshab on, I know he's given you a lot of credit for some of the species he's keeping. I know some of his collection kind of matches yours quite well. How has that been over the years, being able to be an influence on newer keepers coming into, you know, this hobby that you had to, you know, learn stuff from scratch on?
Well, there was only, like I said, 3 people ever asked all the stupid questions to. And I've tried to mentor many people, and Chris is like one of my success stories, I guess, because he picked it up. So a lot of people are this in it for a couple of years and they get out. So really don't know how to answer your question, except for you got to learn how to tweak everything you're doing every year until you get it what you think is the best results possible. And right. I think Chris understands that well.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, he uses silly golf tees holding eggs and marks the tops, and he's a fucking lizard breeder. Oh, sorry. He's a lizard breeder.
Chris, I hope you're listening whenever you listen to this. It makes some cool lizards, though, so I'll give him that.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's funny. All right, cool,
snakes,
man,
are the easiest reptile to keep.
I agree with you.
Anything you can slide open, drop a meal in, is better than crushing vegetables and putting Missouri food in. That's just too much work.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
Clean it one day a week, feed it another day a week. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool, man. Is there anything I missed? Anything else you wanted to elaborate on with these
Species. Not really. I've been in the process of writing a book for over 10 years.
Okay.
I ran into a mutation with Mexmex, which is the hypoerythroism, that I have not figured out yet how it transforms. How do you make more hypoe Mexmex? If you breed a hypoe to a hypoe, you'll get maybe a clutch of eight. You might be half of them might be hypoe.
Interesting.
You breed a hypoe to a classic phase, you'll get zero hypoes. Read a hypoe to a black phase, you'll get half hypoes. So I think it's allelic is a term with black phase. I have not bred normals that come out of a hypoe clutch to each other yet.
To each other. Okay.
Or back to the parents yet. So I'm waiting to figure that all out before I try to get
and now book
published.
This hypoe, that's one mutation per se by itself. Okay.
I think it is. You're trying to see if it's codominant or incomplete dominant and see if there's a super phase, right? Is that what you're getting
at? No, because hypo and erythristic, I'm not sure if those were two separate things or if that's
so the one erythristic thing by itself. To me just means red pigment.
Yes.
So the way they use it in corns and in Brookside is very strange to me. So urethrin is red orange.
Yeah.
Urethrin. Hypo just means reduced red.
Gotcha.
Hypo.
Okay.
Urethrin, right?
Gotcha. Okay.
Like hypomelanism. People just call it hypo. I say hypo what? Hypomelanism.
Okay. So you don't like anerythristic is That's, what you're saying.
Anery means there's none.
Okay.
And red is replaced by white. Like a anery. There's anery alterna that are gray with white saddles.
Okay. So you're saying these are just reduced red.
Yeah, they're pink saddles.
Gotcha.
And it's dimorphic too. The males have pink saddles and the females have purplish pink saddles.
Interesting. Okay.
Which are not as nice looking as a classic, but they're still popped up and I got to try to figure it out.
Yeah.
Nothing beats a fire engine red saddled snake. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
I gotcha. No, that's super interesting, man. I hope you are able to figure that out.
If not, I'm going to put it out and say to be continued and have an addendum later. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of deal with that with the cadmium Texas rats. I know a few people were interested with that because funny enough, it's a sexually dimorphic like mutation type thing where it completely alters the color of the animal. But it came from a guy breeding like an interesting colored Texas to some wild caught one or something. And that's where they popped up. There's a whole website about it and I should probably reread it to re-educate myself. Cause I've read it before, but
was he like close to Houston?
I forget exactly where he was. He was in Texas. And yeah, I forget exactly how the story was. I read it a while ago.
I know a school teacher that lives close to Houston that started breeding wild caught snakes and produced some cadmium babies some years ago.
Really? Okay.
When I talk to you next time, I'll have his name.
Okay. I'll send you the website because maybe it's the same person. I don't know.
Yes, Travis. Chris Montrose just answered it.
Okay. I think I know who that is. Gotcha. All right. Cool, man. So kind of getting into my wrap-up questions here. I kind of ask everyone these, but what's a big motivator? Because it's been, you know, it's been going on 30 years of you doing this, but what's the biggest motivator for what keeps you going with reptiles? Keeps you getting up every day and keeping and breeding these things?
If you ever seen a Leonis clutch hatch, you'll be addicted. Look, there's a black one. There's a banded one. There's a milk snake phase one. There's a saddled one. It's orange. That one's green. That one's yellow. That one's it's just addicting to me to watch eggs hatch.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no matter how many clutches I hatch, nothing, it gets me so excited every time. So I'm with you there.
Oh yeah,
for sure. Cool. And what does the future hold for Coastal Bend captive breeding over the next, let's say, 3 to 5 years or so? Are there any maybe changes you foresee? Any species you maybe want to add? Like, what is what does the future hold for you and what you're doing over there?
Well, I got a little chat group with Chris Groppin, Chris Painshob, and a couple of other buddies, and they're all Pituophis nuts. And I already had all of these Mexican Pituophis at one time and got rid of them, so I might get some back one of these days, Chris.
There you go.
I'm reading Nathan's comments.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I can pull that up. Same with hypoerythristic Sinaloans.
Yeah, but wasn't that a recessive trait, Nathan? If you breed hypoe to hypoe, you're going to produce all hypoes? Or was there a super form of that to make it incomplete dominant? I don't remember. I do remember you producing them, though. Like I said, these Asian king snakes, they're really just snakes. I don't even know if they're rat snakes or what, but they're wolf snakes.
Lycodon. My bad.
Rufozinatum.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Defunct now is Diodon. They were Diodon at one time.
Okay. Yeah, Lycodon is that whole group of those wolf snakes. They're in their own class, not even like rat snake or anything like that. So yeah.
Yeah, people call them Asian king snakes because they eat other snakes, lizards, frogs, rodents, everything.
Yeah.
I think they fit with me well. I used to breed leopard rat snakes, Dion's rat snakes, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
All the same way I do my other snakes now. So I've kind of cut back on a lot of snakes. I mean, I used to have way too many. So if it gets into my collection, it's a hard decision right now.
Leopards are hard to come by, man. Do you really regret letting those go?
Yeah,
we're talking like Zaminis, right?
Yeah, Zaminis.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Back then they weren't, though. I don't know.
Okay.
I kind of gone through the cycles with everything. I remember when ball pythons first came on the scene. Right. I bought my first one for $14 at the snake farm up the road, right? I raised it up, and my buddy said, well, that's a blackback. I'll trade you something for it. And I don't know. I saw Honduran milk snakes crash the colubrid. I mean, not crash it. It raised up colubrids in general. I remember Honduran milk snakes going for $2,000 or $3,000 a piece. The first snows and ghost and albino tricolored and all that is very, very different. And then I saw it crash, not the whole market, but they crashed. And then, like I said, I like to see people like Kayla. Kayla's working with a good group, and there's still people working with some old lines like the Jop Kuj line and all these other aberrant lines. But a Honduran milk snake back in the day was a 6-foot milk snake, and it was two inches in diameter. It was huge.
Yeah.
And that's why people call them hobby milks now, or hobby
because, Durans.
Yeah, because there's a lot of genes went into them for all the morphs.
Right. All right. Cool, man. And then my last one to leave off on is, like, what would you say to someone who's looking to get into these montane king snakes? Maybe it's a first-time colubrid owner. Maybe it's someone who works with reptiles already, and this is what they want to jump into. What's kind of your message or your elevator pitch for these species that you work with?
Yeah, no impulse buying. Make sure you know the lines. Make sure you're getting a pure snake, not a hybrid. They're so polymorphic, it's hard to tell if they are crossed with something. So contact me. Contact people that
I was going to say. And if someone did want to purchase something from you, they could contact you social media, like Instagram, yep. Facebook, that stuff.
Yep, instant message.
Yeah. And I have the link to your Instagram in the description. So if you guys aren't following John already, please go over to Instagram and follow him. He's on Facebook too. And yeah, so.
That's it. Like I said, if you want a pure animal, and then if you want support, if you purchase an animal from me or someone I recommend, because there's probably maybe 10 people I could recommend, and that's about it. There's only about 10 people in the nation I would buy snakes from. So,
10, I think 10 is still a big number for some people, because depending on the species, there might not even be 10 that they would recommend.
Right. Well, I'm talking about if I want an Asian king snake, I know who to go to.
Right.
Or
right.
Asian rat snake. If I want a Pituophis, I know who to go to. If I want, yeah.
True. All right. Cool,
that's
man.
That's about it, man.
I hope
it was good.
Awesome. Yes. No, this was very good. I hope the audience listening got a little one history lesson out of this, and just hearing what you have to say. And maybe it's something that it's information that they were looking for as well, that you can't get everywhere. Cause that's the thing I love about these podcasts, man, is like everything that you just said on here tonight, like, I don't think you could find online. It's not like you can look this up and find, you know, all these things that you said. So I just got to say thank you. Thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate you doing this with me. I'm glad you, or I hope you had a good time.
Oh yeah,
I
did.
And yeah. And I hope the listeners definitely got something out of it. And I think they did.
All right.
I sure did.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, John. I'm going to throw you in the backstage. I'll run the outro and we'll talk after if you want to wait a couple minutes. All right.
Yes, sir.
Cool, man. Guys, what another fantastic episode of the Kluber Corruption Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I saw a bunch of people in the live chat tonight and really appreciate you all listening. I know John would be a popular guest with you all, so glad you're all here tonight. But yeah, like I said, make sure you go follow him. I have his Instagram in the description below, so go check him out. Give him a follow. Check out all the animals he's working with and what he's got. We scrolled through his Instagram a bit before. Guys, follow me on social media at Meteoric Serpents if you're listening to this. Make sure you leave a like on today's podcast. Make sure you hit subscribe on YouTube. Just want to keep it going, guys, and definitely push this out into the algorithm for more snake people, because the more educational snake content out there, the better. So, and we want more people listening to this stuff, more people getting brought into our community. That's what it's all about. First link in the description goes to the Meteoric Serpents Patreon. If you're interested in supporting me a little bit more, and you get a little bit more than what you're getting here on a weekly basis. So consider doing that. As always, the podcast is sponsored by Show Me Reptiles. Thank you again to them for sponsoring today's episode. And that's it for tonight, guys. I hope you had a fantastic week, night, whenever you're listening to this. This was episode number 45 of the Kluber Corruption Podcast, again with John Lasseter. Hope you all enjoyed, and we'll catch you next week. We got a real good guest for next week, guys, and I'll see you on the next one. Peace.